Senator Jensen, welcome to the Tax Committee. Senate File 1451.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Let the record show a quorum is present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Jensen.
Thank you. I'm here to discuss Senate File 1451, Greater Minnesota Business Expansion Bill. In order for our Greater Minnesota cities to grow and prosper, we need new industries to start up in our communities. And most importantly, we need businesses that are already here to stay and expand. There is other legislation being proposed. The Minnesota Investment Fund, which is a loan program established to help Minnesota compete with other regions statewide and nationally for manufacturing and high-tech jobs. There's also the Job Creation Fund, which is a pay-for-performance program established to arm the Department of Economic Development with tools to attract and incent the fastest-growing companies to expand and grow in Minnesota. Current strategies that are already in place, like the Angel Investment Tax Credit Program, which provides a tax credit for private investments in new small businesses, is not working for Greater Minnesota. In 2011, 90% of the businesses receiving those investments were located in the metro area. What this legislation does is it induces existing businesses in Greater Minnesota to increase investment and expand employment in Greater Minnesota. Even though I've been in the legislature only a few months, I can't tell you how many times I've heard legislation described as a tool in the toolbox. I understand also the difficulties that geographical legislation like this can pose, but I'm not willing to sit back and just cross my fingers and hope that some of this legislation will work out in rural Minnesota. With dwindling resources, the pressure to make the best investment for our money is vitally important, and we want to make sure that it doesn't just target population-dense areas. This legislation is easy to use and easy to manage. It has three benefits that DEED can choose from: lower wage thresholds to match Greater Minnesota's economic reality, and greater flexibility. This is my first time testifying before the Tax Committee Chair, so if you want me to walk through the bill section by section, I can. Otherwise, I have some people here that can testify first, and then I can take questions if you would prefer.
Thank you, Senator. I think we'll go through the testimony, and then we'll just touch on the tax provisions. We can take a look at the qualifying business if there's questions about that, but we'll talk about, I think there's a sales tax exemption in here, a statewide business property tax, and then a job credit.
That's correct.
Okay, let's have the testimony first then.
Actually, I'd like to bring up Mayor Tom Kuntz, the mayor of Owatonna.
Mr. Kuntz, or Mayor Kuntz.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's my privilege and honor to be able to testify today. I'm Tom Kuntz, mayor of the great city of Owatonna, and I have been mayor I'm into my 11th year. The provisions that are in Senator Jensen's bill are extremely needed for Minnesota and greater Minnesota. Being in my 11th year, we have done quite a bit of economic development within our community. And every time that we go to a business, some of the business questions are, what can you as a city? Well, as a city, we've got TIF and those type of issues that we can provide. But the next question always comes up is, what can you do from the state of Minnesota? From the state of Minnesota, Job Z has been very, very important to us. And an extension of Job Z or some modification of it is extremely needed. When we are looking at business growth in southern Minnesota, and especially Owatonna, it's not only bringing in new jobs into our community. We have a greater threat from global position now that we have threats of losing jobs to overseas. We have threats of losing jobs to other states. An example is that we committed with Georgia and Utah and Mexico on retaining 500 jobs within our community here not too long ago. And the packages that Georgia has to offer far exceed what Minnesota has to offer. So we need state help in making sure that we can retain these jobs and grow new jobs within Minnesota. As Senator Jensen said about the Angel Tax Credit, That's a great program, but 95% of it's used in greater in metropolitan areas. So we need stuff that's available for greater Minnesota, and hopefully that we can take these things forward. It's not only these three bills that are on the table, but also being able to find funding for these bills is very, very important. There's been many a times that we've had the state come down and say these programs are available, but currently we don't have any funds for them. So when we look at these programs, please look at funding for them also. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I also have Barry Wilfert. He's the president of East Grand Forks Chamber of Commerce.
Mr. Wilfert.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barry Wilfert, president of the Grand Forks, North Dakota, and East Grand Forks, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Over my 30-year career, I've run chambers of commerces in three Minnesota cities, a city in South Dakota, and now the Chamber of Commerce in Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. In Grand Forks, in East Grand Forks, I represent 900 businesses in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and 100 businesses in East Grand Forks, Minnesota. The Red River runs between the two communities, which to the consumer really seems, the community really seems just like one city of 65,000 people. On one side of the river, virtually every fee, regulation, and tax is more favorable for business than on the other side, and this is really having an impact in our communities. In the last 2 years, two of our up-and-coming manufacturers in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, have expanded, not to their adjacent existing facility in Minnesota, unfortunately, but to new satellite locations just across the river in Grand Forks, North Dakota. I'm on the economic development boards in both of the cities. In Grand Forks, we do not actively recruit businesses in northwest Minnesota. In fact, we discourage it. Businesses come to us to expand in North Dakota, and only then do we work with them. We would much prefer that they stay in their northwest Minnesota communities so those communities can stay strong. We need this because these northwest Minnesota communities are a vital part of our regional trade area. We need them to thrive and stay healthy. Fortunately for Minnesota, most existing companies want to stay and expand in Minnesota, but we need tools in greater Minnesota to help level the playing field. Senate File 1451 can help encourage companies in greater Minnesota to invest in Minnesota instead of moving or opening satellite facilities in surrounding states. From a greater Minnesota business community point of view, this is a good bill. Thus, I urge your support, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. And nothing from Mr. Miller? Questions, members? Senator Chamberlain.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, this is someone mentioned to me, it's first look I've had at it, but apparently a substitute for Job Z that we had out in greater Minnesota. So I think overall it's not a bad idea. I think whenever taxpayers and employees and employers can keep more of the money they earn to reinvest it to create jobs, I think it's a good idea. Subdivision 4 talks about tax incentives. So you would agree that some tax incentives and letting businesses and small businesses and employers keep some of their hard-earned money to reinvest is a good idea?
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Chamberlain, I do. I believe that we need to find ways for those businesses that want to expand. And just seriously, in greater Minnesota, we need to retain those jobs that are there. And this would be an opportunity and a tool that we could use to do that.
Thank you.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is anybody from Deed here? I know I have the governor's jobs bill, which has like $25 million and $30 million, replacing the current jobs program, and instead making it, clearly there's not tax issues because I wasn't before this committee, but it had grants to help expand and retain companies and it was kind of an after the fact, so they had to meet certain criteria when they expanded, and then they had to actually say what they were going to do, because part of the problem, at least in the metro area with the jobs program that was set up before, is that they didn't always follow through. They got the money on the front end and didn't always follow through in creating the number of jobs they said they were going to do. So I was just wondering if anybody was from Deed was here so they could kind of explain the difference and how these two would work together, this one with the other.
Welcome to the Tax Committee. State your name for the record, please.
Kevin McKinnon, Executive Director of Economic Development Division at Deed. The Job Creation Fund is a program that we have rolled out this year as a result of many of the issues that we have dealt with over the years with JobZ. And part of it, as Senator Dietzek points out, is the eligibility up front. And that's part of what we'd had done in the Job Creation Fund, was to clearly define what the goals were and actually have done the work before we give them the tax benefits or the rebate in the case of the Job Creation Fund. This program does open up a number of other businesses to be eligible for the program as I read it today, and also does put a stipulation on some of the businesses that have to be in Greater Minnesota for a year prior to being eligible. There have been a few expansions that we have worked with over the past year that obviously were not in Greater Minnesota before and would not be eligible for that. How it would work together in concert with the Job Creation Fund. The Job Creation Fund basically is to provide a rebate of capital investment and also a rebate on the job creation side. And it's capped as well versus not knowing how much is actually going to the business.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I didn't catch your name. Mr. McKinn?
McKinnon. Kevin McKinnon.
McKinley?
McKinnon.
McKinnon? Thank you. I didn't catch it. Is the governor's jobs proposal, is that an appropriation only, or are there tax credits in the governor's jobs proposal?
Mr. Chair, members, it is an appropriation only.
Appropriation only. Senator Jensen.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzek, I just would like to say that one of the things that this legislation came from is that cash poor businesses that can't use the job creation fund because they don't have the cash to do it up front and wait for the reimbursement would leave those businesses out. So that's one of the benefits of this legislation.
Thank you. And Senator Jensen, we have not been able to get a revenue estimate from the department yet on your bill. So
correct.
We don't have a cost, so we don't know what the expectations is for the sales tax and the statewide business tax, et cetera. Have you guys done any runs on the job credit to know how that might impact businesses and what kind of the range of credits would be?
Mr. Chair, about 10 to 15 million.
About 10 to 15 million on the job credit or total?
Total
bill?
In total.
Well, we'll get the revenue estimate before the tax bill is out, so we'll have a chance to revisit that. Anything else, members? Senator Dietzek.
I have another question. And in the bills we heard from Senator Nelson and Senator Bonoff on angel investment credit and stuff like that, there's the gaming, which is the buyback provision or to keep them from, and is that something, I truly don't know, is that something that should be in here to make sure that some other larger company doesn't come and do that swap in 6 months?
I think Ms.
I don't know, I'm asking.
Can help us there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dietzek, the angel credit is slightly different in that it requires investors to make an investment in a small or newly forming business. And those anti-gaming provisions were so that the small business didn't turn around and sell its shares and become public and therefore kind of defeat the purpose of investing in a small business program. The programs in Senate File 1451 are strictly tax credits for the business that would expand in Greater Minnesota. So there's no outside investment to a company that would be expanding under this bill.
Anything else, Senator Jensen?
No, I just appreciate your willingness to hear this bill.
Anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate File 1451? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you both. Chair will lay Senate File 1451 over for possible inclusion. And when we get the revenue estimate, Senator Jensen, I think you and all have to sit down and visit about this a bit, okay?
I'd be very happy to do that. Mr.
Thank you. Senator Tomsoni.
Morning, Mr.
Welcome
Chairman.
Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Tomsoni.
Good to be here. Did you get snow?
Lots of snow.
6 inches in my driveway on Saturday.
Right up north again.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 240 is a tax credit for job training, and this is about all the things that we're hearing from businesses about having positions available but not having qualified people to fill the positions. And so this is an attempt to try and create a training program that will be nimble enough to meet the needs of the economy and meet the needs of the businesses. So what this bill basically does is it has several opportunities for greater job training through an on-the-job training with private instructors, MinSCU instructors, University of Minnesota, and private colleges. And the issue most Minnesotans face is the inability to pay for the training. So the Greater Minnesota Job Training Tax Credit helps reduce the cost for both the employees and the employers by providing training funding for specific jobs and businesses that meet the qualifications. To qualify for the job training funding, a business must be expanding or locating in Minnesota for the first time. The business must be located outside the metropolitan area and creating new jobs, and filling openings of pre-existing jobs does not count. DEED approves the new job cost and training method that the employer will use and verifies that no other training program fits the employer's needs. The new employee must be paid at least $13 per hour plus benefits by the end of 1 year and must be employed at least 32 hours per week. Once a contract is signed between DEED and the employer pays for the training. The employer is then reimbursed as new employee tax withholdings accrue, either with a grant from DEED or a tax credit from the Department of Revenue. The credit or grant is funded through tax withholdings of the new employees. The business may not collect more money in training credits from the state than the withholdings of the new employee's taxes over a 10-year period. And if the employee quits or the business closes, no more credits or grants from withholdings may be offered. The cost of the program is $10 million per year and does not apply to temporary work, recalled workers, or replacement workers. And the key here is that the money comes from the withholdings of the new employees.
So, Senator Tomsoni, how does the training play into the credit again? Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Miller with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and Flaherty and Hood. The way it would work is in a situation where you have one or two or even five new employees that you've brought on to do new work, they may not have the skills necessary to do that work. There's a much greater skills gap in Greater Minnesota than there is in the Twin Cities. So what the business would be allowed to do is create a job training program, and that could be through on-the-job training, through a contract with a college, or by bringing in a private trainer. However much that training costs, the business would be able to claim for a tax benefit. That tax benefit would be paid by taking the income tax withholdings of the trained employee, putting it in a separate account, and reimbursing the business as that tax money accrues. So you would never be able to get back more money than the employee's tax withholdings over a 10-year period or the cost of the training itself.
So, Mr. Miller, would that be 100% of the cost?
It's 100% of the cost unless it's an on-the-job training situation, in which case it's 50% of the cost. The theory behind that, Mr. Chair, is that on-the-job training, the costs, but you would, if we didn't do that, the entire wage of the employee could be considered training cost, and that's not what we're looking to do. We're looking to only pay for the training.
So a CPA firm in Bagley needs to hire a new CPA. Could they hire a first-year college kid and then get a credit for the 3 years or 4 years of college? How are you thinking about that?
Mr. Chair, they could if they paid that employee enough that their tax withholdings, that the employee's income tax withholdings matched the amount of the training.
And how many years can they go forward to collect those?
10 years, Mr. Chair.
10 years? Okay. I think I understand it. Any questions, members?
Yeah. Mr. Tomasoni. Senator Tomasoni, I'm wondering if this has any inclusion of the concerns that were in the NPR latest article, that part of the problem with the lack of skilled employees with jobs was that of the pay scale and the hours and the conditions of the job, that was almost, I think it was 2 out of 3 jobs that was the issue.
Give me more information.
Senator Thompson.
Well, in the article, Senator, they did this. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni. In the article, they did a study of, I think it was like 1,500 people, and they discovered that, well, they were jobs, and they were primarily healthcare and IT and one other skilled position, I can't remember. But anyway, they found that only 1 out of 3 jobs was not filled because of a skilled person. It wasn't filled because of the conditions of the employment.
Well,
Senator Tomasoni,
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Eaton, I'm not sure I can answer that without knowing more information about the actual study they did. But I think the idea here is to be able to pay the person a wage where it entices somebody to actually go do the job. And if you're talking health care, I can understand where there's a big problem there, because there's so many people that are paid $9 or $10 or $11 an hour. And so this is at least to try and get somebody to go to a job that has a living wage, where they learn some skills and where the employer is actually providing some of the training so that they get the type of worker that they want to have. And I still haven't been able to actually figure out if all these claims about jobs being available but not enough skilled people is true. But if they keep telling us this, I have to assume that it's true. And so somewhere along the way, I think that it's incumbent upon us to try and do something to try and fill the jobs. If there are, in fact, 60,000 jobs available for people with higher skills, then we got to figure out a way to try and help them out. And so I think this goes a long way to doing that. And it does it based on the fact that the person's working and the taxes that the person pays actually ends up paying for the credit that we're looking at here. So I think it's a pretty creative way of doing this.
And Senator Eaton, I don't know if it helps or not, but there is a requirement that the minimum wage be $13 an hour. It's on page 2, line 32.
And Mr. Chairman, we have somebody who can answer the question even better.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Robert Broder. I'm the mayor of Le Sueur, Minnesota, and I want to say more about that bill in a moment, but to answer your question, I think of one of the companies in our community, which is Cambria. Is expanding. They presently, depending upon other action, either from 250 to 500 jobs. Now, the concern that keeps being expressed to me, and they're paying that wage or greater, is they still have trouble getting enough persons with the skills to handle the jobs.
And, Mayor, why don't you continue on with your testimony?
Okay, certainly will. As I mentioned, I'm Robert Broder, the mayor of Le Sueur, Minnesota, which is a community about a little over 50 miles from here as you enter the Valley of the Jolly Green Giant. We're very fortunate to have a community that has a quite a bit of industry. A number of them are desiring to expand, which we celebrate, as I'm sure you do throughout the state. But we as a state need to be concerned on a statewide basis of how we will help to encourage job growth and companies to expand. And one of the problems is when a company's starting to look ready to expand, it's going to take a little bit of capital for that to happen. And many times when the person first comes on to work, they're not what we'd call they're not up yet to the full task of providing what the potential can. Therefore, for the first maybe period of time, it's a cost to a company. And one of the ways that also with a number of people sometimes in their 40s or 50s who maybe have done a great job at whatever they did, but now they're out of a job and they need additional training in order to make them able again to a full-time position,
yes.
Need that extra training. And companies in order to, I think, kind of take that chance, need some assistance along on the way. And I see this as a program where it can be beneficial to reducing the unemployment, at the same time beneficial to encouraging companies to expand, and at the same time being somewhat cost neutral in that its effect of the state by the method that it's being funded.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr.
Senator
Chamberlain.
Senator.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I might point out that my main witness is not from the Iron Range, and he's from Le Sueur, well, as far away as he can get. And so this is a pretty good statewide program.
Certainly agree. I'm certainly for the Iron Range, too.
No.
That's why I say statewide. We got to do this together.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomassoni. Hey, I have a radical idea. Thanks, by the way, for coming from Le Sueur, not the Iron Range.
Ho, ho, ho. Yeah.
Even better. I'm going to propose something radical here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chairman, I want to point out that I'm a state senator, not just a senator from the Iron Range.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So something radical here. Senator Jensen's bill had proposed anywhere from $10 to $15 million cost. We didn't have a fiscal note there yet. This fiscal note here proposed about $10 million annually going forward. So let's use the high number, $25 million. And again, I'll go on the record for the 1,000th time that I think it's a good idea for companies to keep some of their own money to reinvest. But first piece is that it seems that, in my mind, you know, we can get to the same spot if we said something radical like, why don't we start reducing statewide business property taxes? It's a huge burden on all these companies. Now, the governor had it in his original proposal to freeze the inflator on that for a while. And then they would have that. So we end up with there is that you're still spending $25 million a year here in just in these two pieces of legislation. But if you froze the by doing this, creating four pages of legislation here, which generates probably five times a page in code, then you create jobs and government folks to do that, and then you can create compliance costs on the businesses to track this. So you had those two costs. You know, in my simple mind, I think if we start reducing or freezing the inflator on the business property tax, these businesses will have that money to grow and invest as they see fit. That's first thing. I think it'd be a good way to save the taxpayers and Minnesotans some money and let the businesses go and expand how they can. The second thing is I have a big concern with this floor for wages. I think it might inhibit companies from implementing these ideas, because we all like $13 an hour. We all like the idea of a living wage, but perhaps there's a job that it isn't worth $13 an hour. They can't pay him $13 an hour because of the cost of doing business and the market. But we're saying you have to this is de facto a minimum wage increase with this bill and with the previous bill. When we set floors at least $13 an hour, I know it's been done in the past, we are doing that, and I think we inhibit
businesses and cause some problems there and restrain them from possibly growing where they could grow, because they're not going to get a credit because they charge, they can only pay the employee $12 an hour or $11 an hour. So two issues. One is more of a statement, the business property tax. I think it'd be a lot easier way to go, you know, with the governor's original idea of freezing the inflator, letting the companies and businesses grow and expand as they see fit with that money. Saves the state a lot of money. We don't waste it. And secondly, these minimum wages that we're introducing into legislation through these other mandates and these programs. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just a response to both of those, Senator Chamberlain. Your first approach is a way to do it, but the problem is that there's no guarantee that any jobs are going to be created. And in fact, if you look across the country, you'll find that businesses are sitting on trillions of dollars in cash and not creating any jobs. So giving them more cash doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to create jobs. And so this incentivizes companies to actually create jobs that they need. And the $13 an hour thing is more of an issue with the high-skilled jobs. And so because that's what we're hearing they're not being able to find. We're hearing that they're not being able to find jobs that they need in order to advance their business because they can't find the workers with the skills. And so if they have a minimum wage job, it's something that, or even a little bit more than a minimum wage job, it's probably something that doesn't need high skills. This is intended to incentivize the business as well as the employee to get into a job that's open, that needs training, that needs higher skills. And in many cases, what you want to have happen is you want to have the people have the openings, get the jobs, and not have the employees go to another place that might have a similar type of job that pays even more. And so this is actually a bill that is looking at solving a problem and not just creating more cash for a company in hopes that a company might hire some people.
Mr. Miller, did you have something to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain. We came to $13 an hour because it is 125% of federal poverty for a family of four. And if you notice in the legislation, it's $13 an hour by the end of the first year. So a person could be hired at a training wage and then bumped up to $13 after the training is completed. The reason we chose 125% of federal poverty is because that gets at the skilled labor. This isn't a situation where a new McDonald's restaurant could open and use this program. We were looking at manufacturing, tech, added value to agriculture, jobs of that nature that are more careers than retail would be.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 240?
I'm supposed to.
Senator Tomasoni, a couple things. I see this as first in, first out. So when they meet the $10 million threshold, the people would no longer be eligible till the next year. And then, do you have any expectations of the participation the first year, and whether this, what would your thoughts be on how scalable this might be, Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, we feel that this bill is incredibly scalable. It's a matter of kind of testing the waters to see how well the program will work. We feel like there is $10 million worth of need out there, but if the committee has other priorities and this needs to be scaled back to $5 million, our feeling is that the demand by the end of the first or second year will be such that hopefully your hand will be forced to increase it.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Senator Tomasoni or the testifiers. One of the concerns that we have regarding kids who are graduating from high school, we know that 40% of those kids need remediation before they're able to enter college. And what is there in this bill that would ensure that this particular legislation would not be used to pay for remediation? In other words, that would be used directly for training, for jobs, but the training is not what should have been accomplished in high school. In other words, it's something specific to the industry or the job or the employer, but it's not high school remediation.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the cost to the business would be higher to do the remediation than they would get in a tax benefit from this program. The benefit is capped by how much money the employee pays in income taxes. To do the remediation plus the training, the business would never see that money come back. This is designed to be a bridge for $500, $1,000, $1,500 worth of training for someone who maybe graduated from a tech school 20 years ago and the equipment's changed. It's something designed at that. With the money that is withheld from the employees' taxes, they would the business would never get back the remediation plus the job training. It's not going to be a free-for-all in that way since they're capped by what the employees' taxes are.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Actually, that's clear enough. I just want to get that on the record, that it's not about remediation. All right, thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, would this be the time to offer an oral amendment?
Sure.
All right. One that I hope Senator Tomasoni will accept as a friendly amendment, and I'm going to ask our counsel, Ms. Pollack, to actually give the language. I'll tell you what I'd like the amendment to do, and then I'll have our counsel give the actual language. In the section of the bill that's talking about the report that's coming back to the legislature on February 1, 2016, I believe that's on page 5, I'd like to add the criteria that the report also include the number of women and minority-owned businesses that are participating in the program. This is something that's similar to language that I had in my angel investor tax credit. I know that that's something that's important that we have in times past have had to go back and try and figure out, but it just seems like it'd be a good piece to add to the report at this point. And so,
Ms. Pollack, can you help us with the language?
Mr. Chair and members, to accomplish Senator Nelson's amendment on line 5.12, delete and. On 5.13, delete the period and insert a semicolon, and then insert. And 7, the number of businesses in the program that are women or minority owned.
I think that's acceptable.
And Senator Nelson, are you trying to get at just the ownership or perhaps the trainees?
Oh, I think that's a good question. I think the more information we can have, the better. So perhaps we should expand that to the number of businesses and the number of trainees. I think both would be good metrics to have.
Senator Tomasoni, what are you thinking about this?
I Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I think ever since you've been to the Ranger Party, you're coming around. So I think this is fine, Mr. Chairman. And I don't mind if we know who the businesses are and who the people are hiring is. I think that's okay.
Oh, sure. And members, this would be number 6, and we'll get the language to work, but I think we should vote on the amendment, and then if there's a little language adjustment we need later on, that okay, Senator Nelson?
Yes, and I would like to include both metrics.
Okay,
I think that's important.
Senator Nelson offers the oral amendment as read. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Thank you, Senator Nelson. Anything else, members? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if this question's been answered or asked, rather. I'm just trying to think back of my own district and those businesses that might take advantage of this. And it just seems to me that if a business is going to hire one or two or five or 10 new employees because they see some good future in doing that, that they're going to go ahead and do that as just an investment in their future and don't really need a tax credit incentive to do it because they're personally incented because of potential business growth to do that. And so that's my question. Is there a feeling that we have businesses out there that want to grow but aren't going to grow because they have to train new employees?
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chairman and
Senator
Senjum, I think the issue here is that we're hearing from business that they can't find the employees that meet the criteria of the jobs that they need and that because they're not qualified. And so I believe what this bill is trying to do is to get businesses to actually participate in the qualifying and training of the employees that they're looking for so that they get the people they need. And by providing them with an incentive to do so, I think that will help. I know from a personal experience standpoint on the Iron Range where we have provided tax credits or incentives to businesses to hire people that it has worked. And in this particular case, since we're hearing so much from businesses across the state that they have job openings but they can't find qualified people, that maybe if they participate in training those people for the jobs that they have open, that they'll be able to hire new people. So I don't think it's a matter of businesses not who need people to go out and hire them. I think it's a matter of the businesses telling us that they can't find the qualified people, and so they participate in the training of the people so they have the people they want and the people that are qualified to do the job. So I think that's the idea here, and maybe if I didn't express that right, Mr. Miller can help out.
Mayor Broder, and then we're going to lay this bill.
Senator Senjum, also I think in terms of, yes, for some larger companies and all, which you say is probably true, but for many smaller companies that are wanting to expand, and in our own community in Lesueur, we've had a number of companies who have started out in garages and maybe added on a few employees and stuff, and then they have the desire and the market is there to expand greater further. But as being a smaller company, they need sometimes extra help because they may not have the funds that available, and this would at least to provide maybe that extra training for folks that are, say, in their 40s or so and who need a opportunity to be retrained so they can get hired, and who also have some very good work skills and are hardworking individuals. This would give them that maybe extra incentive and bump that they can in order to do the expanding, because I see it as being a much more advantage to smaller companies.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, in every work experience I've ever observed or been part of personally, you enter into it, and frankly, you spend maybe the first month, the first year, whatever, couple of years learning your job, and you learn it from others. And tax credits, really weren't necessary. It just seems like an employer that wants to move ahead is going to do this because it's a good investment for them. But I'm probably missing something, and I'll relent to that. But and maybe it's a generational thing. Could well be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, I don't think you're missing anything. I think you're absolutely right. But I think what we're hearing from business is that they can't find qualified people. And when I participated in the a forum over at the University of Minnesota with an exchange from Germany, and there was a Swiss company there that was providing apprenticeships on the job at their company because, and you were there with me,
yep.
Remember, they were doing it because they needed to train the people to do the jobs exactly as they wanted them to do them, and they were actually paying people to go to school, if you remember correctly, and while they were on the job. So that was an instance where I thought, maybe there's something that we can help out with here, and I think this thing is going to provide a little bit of an incentive to some companies to maybe try and help train people on the job at their own sites where they maybe would not have done it before.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Thank you, Mayor Broder. Chair is going to lay Senate File 240 as amended over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Senator Eakin. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Eakin. Senate File 241 first.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate File 241 is the Greater Minnesota Internship Tax Credit. This is a program that's designed to address a couple of different issues in our area. For one thing, the out-migration of young people from our area and trying to keep more young people in our communities and finding good jobs for them there and helping businesses out as well in being able to find good qualified employees in our area. In some cases, students do not realize that businesses and job opportunities are available. Initiatives that develop public-private partnerships are required in order to help attract and maintain talent in Greater Minnesota. And that's what this bill does. It provides some and creates some beneficial relationships between businesses and students and cities that will generate economic growth in Greater Minnesota. Students receive critical learning opportunities through this program, educational credit, and they get a foot in the door with a local business. And communities and businesses can retain qualified and good quality workers in their communities. The bill authorizes a new internship program. It would be administered by the Office of Higher Education, and it would apply to all post-secondary institutions eligible for the state grant program. All of the internships must be located in Greater Minnesota, and that the definition of that is outside the 11-county metropolitan area. And the legislation requires also that it must be taken for academic credit, and employers would receive funding to help pay the interns. So it also helps college students pay for college as well, because it would provide them with pay, obviously. The legislation authorized tax credit of 40% of the intern's compensation, up to $4,000 per intern for a maximum of 5 interns in a taxable year, and it limits the total tax credits in the biennium to $11 million. So the appropriation being asked for would be $11 million. This would provide for 2,400 internships lasting 24 weeks. It does require that students be admitted to a major program that's related to the intern experience. We had some discussion in the last committee about how directly connected that would have to be. We do want it to be flexible, so it doesn't necessarily have to be in the exact area of their major. The institutions must have written agreements with the employers for internships that last 12 weeks or longer, pay at least minimum wage for a minimum of 16 hours per week, and provide academic credit for the internship. Employers must also state that the intern will not be replacing existing employees, and again, the interns will be working for credit. The program does exclude clinical internships, so for instance, things like student teaching would not be included in this. And with that, I do have a couple of testifiers with me today. One is a student of Mariah Miles, who can speak to the benefits of the internship programs here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Eakin. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Ms. Miles.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senators, as stated, my name is Mariah Miles. I'm a senior at MSU Mankato, and I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. We represent the 75,000 students that go to the 7 state universities, so Southwest State, Mankato, Winona, Metro, St. Cloud, Bemidji, and Moorhead. We're an independent nonprofit funded and run by students. So my story briefly, I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and went to South Dakota State University for a year and a half. At that point, I decided to transfer to MSU Mankato. My first day on campus was the day I moved in. And I wasn't that big of a fan of the Mankato community. I just loved the school and my academic program. I decided that this was a career move because I left all my friends and my family back in South Dakota, and that I would soon be joining them again when my degree was finished. But however, the fates had a different idea in mind. I decided to get involved in student leadership, and somehow I wound up in front of the head of the HR department for Taylor Corporation. Through that, I received an internship, and through that experience, they have offered me a full-time job at one of their companies in Greater Minnesota. This was an excellent opportunity, and it opened my eyes to the talent within our Greater Minnesota communities. That's really what has attracted me to Minnesota and decided to stay in Minnesota. And so with that, that's my story, and our association backs up this bill entirely, and we really need our students to have these opportunities to them, because my story isn't very uncommon. There are many students that come here with the intent to return back, or we want to travel to somewhere outside of Minnesota, outside of the Midwest, and this allowed me to see the talent and want to be a part of this talent. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Miles. Glad that you stayed in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Mayor Algren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Algren. I'm the mayor of the city of Cloquet, and also the president of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'm here to encourage you to pass the Greater Minnesota Intern Tax Credit. My city is home to Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, and just down the road there are this College of St. Scholastica and the University of Minnesota Duluth. Our area of the state is also home to several industries that require a unique set of skills. The Greater Minnesota Intern Tax Credit will help match our students with our businesses. Greater Minnesota needs different tools to encourage business growth and employee creation and retention than the Twin Cities. We need tools to keep strong workforce in our regions. In this case, Greater Minnesota businesses were hit hard by the 2008 recession. One of the things that disappeared were internship opportunities. Those internships have not returned. Businesses have expressed a willingness to start to bring them back and a need to push for incentives. Because of the lack of intern opportunities, our young adults believe there are no opportunities for work. It has become increasingly difficult to keep brain power in the Greater Minnesota as students either leave our cities and go to college or never come home. And after they attend local colleges, they migrate to the cities for jobs. We need to match our students with businesses, allow them to get a foot in the door. The businesses need to see that there are many talented and innovative students that will fit their future plans. Minsky recognizes this and has asked internship dollars to be in their budget. However, that funding would do nothing to encourage businesses to begin an internship program. The value of this program lies in showing students that businesses have opportunities in Greater Minnesota. In the metro area, it's clear that there are these opportunities and that businesses are actually competing over the best students to come out of specific programs in specific colleges. We need to create that atmosphere for our kids as well. Internships show students how to work, how to be part of the business team, and how to get things done the right way. In this program, they will be evaluated, graded by the businesses, and they will receive college credit. This is on top of the wages that they will receive and pay them for their entire college experience. The bill provides incentives to businesses, will allow students to see that there are jobs available in Greater Minnesota, and will give them reasons to stay. It is a summer internship, and the student may spend the summer in rural communities, enjoy it, and become a permanent resident. It is a win for students, businesses, and cities. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Any questions, members? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, I think you were mentioning that this does not apply to, like, student teaching type of thing, and I think you said political internships and so on. I didn't see that in the bill. I was just curious what referred to that. Is there a specific language you're saying the intent is not to?
Well, Senator Eakin, or I see Mr. Miller is coming forward.
It's Senate Council, too.
Your Senate Council? Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, on page 2, line 29, paragraph E, an internship required to complete an academic program does not qualify for this Greater Minnesota internship program. So as Senator Eakin mentioned, these would be things like student teaching or lab clinical experiences that are required to complete the degree.
Anything else, members? Senator Eakin.
Yes.
I know that the High Tech Association has an internship program, and I appreciate the effort working for Greater Minnesota, but I think we should think about whether we want to make this a statewide program and then just have some goals and some requirements that it gets distributed adequately. I know that former legislator speaker Margaret Keller Anderson has talked to me about how successful that High Tech Association internship program is. So I wonder if we shouldn't talk to that association and maybe see if we can do something a little broader, but put some goals and some criteria in there so it's a little more of a statewide program. I think I might be a little more comfortable with it.
Well, I'm Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments on that, and certainly we'd be open to that. I guess there's always concern about the funding and whether
sure. We
can do it statewide, but and my main concern is that we bolster some economic development in the Greater Minnesota communities that have been losing young people. But certainly it's a program that would be good statewide if it's something that we could afford.
I don't see the revenue estimate right in front of me now, but I've got $5.5 million written down and scalable. So $5.5 million. And I know Senator Nelson had this effort last year and has worked on this, so I think it's worth consideration, and I don't know what the rest of the committee thinks about how we would approach that, but we have some other initiatives that we're trying to set some goals and targets so that they get spread across the state. I think this would work also for that, and so maybe we should talk about that a little bit. Anything else, members? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going off Senator Marty's question, if an intern isn't related to an academic program, what is the question is, what is an intern? I don't see it defined.
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, Mike Miller with Flaherty and Hood and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. In order to qualify for this program, an intern must be a student at a state grant receiving institution in Minnesota, which is it's your obviously your MinSCU institutions, University of Minnesota, the private nonprofits, and several of the private for-profit schools. They need to be receiving college credit for this internship experience. This isn't a summer job sort of situation. This is where the business and the student have gone to the school and said, I'd like to take this job for 3 credits this semester. And that's the only way you could qualify for this tax credit.
Senator Senjum.
So then, again, going off Senator Marty's question, if to be an intern is required as part of being advancing through an academic program, it doesn't apply. But if... Am I saying this right? But if you don't need to be an intern to graduate from whatever coursework you're doing, then you can be an intern. Is that right?
Mr. Chair,
I probably haven't said that very well, but
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, I understood what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yes, this is for a student who maybe takes an internship as an elective course.
Okay.
Not as a mandatory course.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chair, and that's being done, Senator
Egan.
Obviously, the ones that are required are going to happen anyway. We want to expand that and make connections with businesses that wouldn't otherwise have these internships.
Okay.
Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 241? Seeing none, Chair will lay Senate File 241 over. Thank you, Senator Eakin. Thank you, members. Senator Eakin, Senate File 389. Senator Eakin, we've had some discussions between myself and Mr. Silva, Senate staff, and Mrs. Off, who's former Senate Tax Committee staff. And if you or your testifier would be willing to give us a little history of this, it would be helpful.
Sure, sure. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And we're doing Senate File 389.
389, Border Cities, Senator Eakin.
Right. And this is a program that was actually first put in place back in 1984. And what was being done here was there's the issue with competition in North Dakota, which really is an anomaly compared to other states around the country because of all the oil money that's being generated there, all the federal subsidies that they receive. And because of that, placed many border city communities at a competitive disadvantage. And this legislation was designed to address that. It sought to decrease the out-migration of businesses that are located in Minnesota to border communities to their North Dakota neighbors through various measures. And it included providing property tax and workers' compensation credits. That was the beginning of the Border Cities legislation, again, back in 1984. They started the Border City Enterprise Zone Program to address these competitive disadvantages. And they have both the Enterprise Zones and the Development Zones, which, again, addresses the tax issue, commercial industrial property taxes, and also taxes on multifamily residential and mixed-use properties. This is it was because of the unique situation that are faced by these border cities communities, which includes Moorhead, which I represent, which is the largest of these border city communities, and of course has Fargo right across the river in competition with them. So, and I do have with me today Michael Redlinger from the city of Moorhead, who can explain in greater detail the program and how it's been utilized up till this point. And just to let you know, as far as what the bill is asking for, is $2 million to be placed into this program. And $1 million can be used for the enterprise zones and $1 million for the development zones. But they can be used, if they're not used in one area, they can be transferred to the other. So with that, again, I have Michael Redlinger here.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Eakin. And thank you for that history. And did you say it started in 1984?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Redlinger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Michael Redlinger. I'm the city manager in the city of Moorhead. I think Senator Eakin has provided a real nice history and background. The thing I would add is that in the early 1980s, it was well documented that Northwest Minnesota and the Red River Valley in particular faced some unique challenges relative to other communities in Minnesota. And at that time, it was really a fact-based mission that the state undertook at that time to determine how to make these communities as competitive as they could be along that North Dakota border. And so that's why we have today the defined program that it is. We'll talk a little bit later as well about another program called the Disparity Reduction Credit that is also a program that maintains a property tax competitiveness between the North Dakota border communities and Minnesota communities. Minnesota's competition, as many of the committee members know well, has been heating up for some time now. And North Dakota, certainly with their oil wealth, with their significant increases in state revenues, as well as future anticipated tax relief for the communities in eastern North Dakota, present unique challenges to Minnesota. These challenges aren't necessarily new, but they are intensified and they are different than what they were back in 1984 when the state studied this phenomenon pretty extensively. What we see today is that the programs that we're talking about are just as relevant, if not more relevant, today than they were even 40 years ago. What the Border City program does is efficiently deliver credits and incentives to qualifying businesses in Moorhead, East Grand Forks, Breckenridge, Ortonville, Dilworth, et cetera, and make sure that these businesses stay as competitive as they can be with their North Dakota counterparts. These are businesses that want to stay in Minnesota, they want to grow in Minnesota, and they want to continue to expand opportunities for their employees. So it's a real win-win for Minnesota when these businesses stay. We reap their economic activity, we reap their sales tax, the state does, as well as their productivity for the economy, which is a good thing. So we want more of that incentive and more of that investment to stay in Minnesota. In 2012 alone, about 150 businesses in Moorhead utilized the program. The resources, however, as Senator Eakin noted, are dwindling quickly. We are down to nearly $60,000 in this account, and this is why this $2 million request is so urgent at this time, because we will have businesses that will need to leave the program if additional funds are not made available. Again, these are employers that are creating economic activity, creating vitality in Minnesota communities, and this request will really help them thrive and stay in the game. And I think that's really the takeaway message that I want to leave with the committee today, is that we know that it's going to change that much more over the next 2 years with this incredible wealth to our border to the west and the communities to the west. This is really about staying in the game and keeping these businesses on as level of a playing field as possible. And the state of Minnesota has really helped us do that. So we appreciate your support and the longstanding support, over three decades now, of the state of Minnesota's support of these businesses and these border communities. Very important and very critical. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Redlinger. So as a farmer from Clearbrook, it's hard for me not to notice that RDO and Titan both build their new facilities and their new distribution centers on the east side of Moorhead. Did this program play a part in those locations?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is correct. We utilize these programs. As Senator Eakin noted, there's $1 million for enterprise zone credits, another million for other economic development activity. But yes, we incent new development, and our handout that is before the committee gives you an idea of how we just do that. And so in exchange for creating jobs, these businesses do receive some tax abatements. So yes, these are, especially in the value-added ag businesses, this is something that very much benefits those businesses.
And do you have a feel for how many jobs those two facilities have? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I wouldn't know right off the top of my head, but obviously a very significant relocation from North Dakota into Minnesota of Mr. Offit's company, a very significant investment for Minnesota and a win for Minnesota.
and the Titan the same way. They're
the
North Dakota company. So thank you. Mr. Chamberlain.
Yeah, thank you.
Or Senator Chamberlain.
That's all right. I'm a mister, too. That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with this bill. That may not be a surprise. But I agree with this, and I'll raise you the rest of the state of Minnesota. You've made my case, you make our case perfectly with this comment, with these last several bills, Senator Eakin and Senator Tomasoni, Senator Jensen, you're making our case, and thank you very much. Thank you very much. I can give you a registration for the Republican Party, because what you've done here is you're saying, gentlemen, ladies, what he's saying here is that tax reductions and tax credits are good for business because they create jobs. Everybody understands that. That is what they're saying. But yet, the governor's budget, my colleague's budget, proposes for the rest of the state $2 billion in extra taxes and $3 billion of, I dare say, wasteful spending. So I agree with the legislation. I like this idea. But what's good for the border cities, why would that not be good for the rest of the state? Why would that not be good for Duluth? Why wouldn't it be good for Faribault? Why wouldn't it be good for Minneapolis or Lionel Lakes? So thank you very much. But this really, you've made our case. So thank you, and I support this. I urge my colleagues to do the rest for the rest of the citizens of this state. How many people live in this area? A couple hundred thousand?
Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair, it's about 40,000 in the Moorhead area, and then Dilworth's about 4,000 or a little over 4,000 people there as well. But I don't know what the populations are of the other border cities. I know Moorhead is the biggest population center there. And as far as what's good for the rest of Minnesota, one thing that would be good for Minnesota is if we had lots of oil wells, too, which we don't have, unfortunately. And that's one of the things that poses a unique situation for a lot of our border city communities. Obviously, it's a different situation right on the border than it is in the rest of Minnesota. So these credits and these tax programs obviously have a much bigger impact on our ability to develop and thrive economically than in other parts of the state. And again, I think that Mr. Redlinger made a great point that this is good for the whole state of Minnesota when we can keep businesses on our side of the river, creating jobs for our people, generating revenue for our state.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you. Well, you know, we have borders on, we got several borders, right, around the state. So, and we had a discussion a couple of years ago, maybe last year, where, you know, they had a similar type of idea. And we thought, well, where do the borders end? Well, the border city zones, they have a border that ends somewhere in Minnesota. I'd offer an amendment to take this statewide. I'll have an amendment to this bill to take this statewide. We will give tax incentives, and we'll figure out the fiscal note later. We can do that. Let's take this incentive, the same incentives we're going to give to the border city that will create jobs by your own admission here, that will be better for Minnesotans and taxpayers. Let's make an amendment, and we'll deal with the fiscal note later, that we will take this border city bill and we'll extend it statewide. So, Mr. Chair, I offer that amendment. As radical as it might be, I offer that amendment. And I'd like a roll call.
When we put the bill together, would you be willing to offer it then?
All right, Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw that. Well, no, we can offer amendment now, right? We're hearing the bill.
Well, we'd have to have staff go and draft that. I don't think that would just be an oral amendment.
Well, we could. We don't need a fiscal note. That was obvious because Senator Jensen was here and she didn't have a fiscal note. I've been in several committees hearings this year, and they were no fiscal notes to be found. And we were told that the cost doesn't matter.
Senator Chamberlain, there will be a fiscal note on Senator Jensen's bill prior to it being included in the tax bill, if it's going to be included. The department has been more than a little bit busy putting the division report together. They asked if there was a possibility they could delay that fiscal note coming. I said this bill is just going to be laid over for possible inclusion. And so before it's going to be considered by the full committee, you will have a fiscal note on Senate File 1451.
I understand that, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I'm not fighting his legislation. I'm lauding it. I'm saying, let's go here. You got the right idea. So I don't know why we couldn't just offer an amendment here. What do we got? We could put language in here somewhere that says we can come up someone by the end of this committee, just striking this saying the Board of City credits and tax credits and tax reductions shall apply same statewide to all businesses and all industry.
Mr.
Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair and members, and there's obviously a cost to that, and the reference I made to the oil wells is that they have that revenue to pay for their schools, their infrastructure, their roads and bridges, and so on. We don't have that here in Minnesota, unfortunately. We have a different situation, and we do need to, however, address the unique situation faced by cities like Moorhead and Dilworth, which are right on the border with a North Dakota city. Obviously, the effects of taxes and the effects of regulations and other things of that nature has a much more significant impact on those cities because they're right on the border and it doesn't take much to nudge businesses over to the other side. So it's a unique situation. We do still need to have revenue for things like our roads and bridges and our schools and our colleges and universities, all of which also attract businesses to our state. And is one of the reasons that many businesses locate here. We certainly don't want to jeopardize that.
Senator Eakin, you've got one more bill up, and we're going to finish you by 10 o'clock. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Senator Eakin and members. I grew up in East Grand Forks. I graduated from high school in East Grand Forks. So you're right, particularly as it pertains to retail and some other things. There are some unique challenges that border cities face. But I think Senator Chamberlain's larger point is the important one, and that is that there is an acknowledgement in this series of bills that tax structure, regulatory structure impacts business dramatically. But the important thing is that impacts families because it impacts their ability to hire people, give people higher wages, and all of these kinds of things. And so I do think that the kinds of things that apply to my hometown of East Grand Forks and to Moorhead and to Duluth and other border cities really ought to apply to the whole state. And also some of our eastern cities here in the metro area are very, very close to Wisconsin, plus many businesses, unlike retail, obviously, with retail and restaurants and those sorts of things, you kind of are set in a location if you want to operate there. We have Fortune 500 companies in this city, metropolitan area. We have medium-sized businesses that, while it certainly is not quite as close geographically to move elsewhere, they have the opportunity to do that. And I think the larger point is we acknowledge by these kinds of things that what we do tax and regulation-wise has a dramatic impact upon employment in this state and the ability of businesses to hire and provide good jobs. And so I would certainly be in favor of anything that would make Minnesota more competitive, whether it's for a restaurant in my hometown of East Grand Forks or a manufacturing firm in Brainerd or a business elsewhere. I think it's very important to do those things.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. And I think we all agree that, tax climate impacts businesses. We understand that. Being sympathetic to it. Senator Chamberlain, can you offer your amendment later on in the time period so I can get Senator Eakin out of here by 10?
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, I would not put the council through rewriting the whole the whole statute that related to this, but I think my colleagues, Senator Eakin and Senator Scoy and others, I think we agree on a lot of stuff. And I think if you open up your hearts once in a while, you'd see that we're on the right track with reducing these taxes and reducing and giving the businesses more ability to compete and hire people so that those people can have productive, prosperous lives, and they can succeed in this state. And, one last comment. We talk about oil wells in North Dakota. Senator Deacon, we should end this really soon because I can keep coming at you with this. We won't open up mines in northern Minnesota. You want a moratorium on silica sand mining. You won't let us get energy from North Dakota as it is. You won't let us build half a dozen other things in this state. So the excuse that North Dakota's got oil doesn't hold because Minnesota's got a lot of resources, natural and otherwise, that we can use and put to good use and allow hardworking Minnesotans to get back to work. But that doesn't seem to be the track we want. With the track we're following here, the path we're following is we'll manipulate and control the businesses and the economy in the state. We will artificially create a minimum wage through tax incentive programs, but we'll control what the businesses do. So I agree with what you're doing. Sorry, Mr. Chair, but we had an opportunity there. So thank you very much.
And Senator Chamberlain, you know that we are going to balance the budget, and we do have a deficit, and that's going to take some resources and some tax dollars also. Thank you, Senator. Chair lays over Senate File 289.
just very quick, yes or no?
Senator Senjum.
And I'll wait for Senator Chamberlain's amendment at a future meeting, I guess. But relative to your bill, I was just looking at the map. Are cities like Climax, Halstead, and Oslo, all which have bridges across the Red River, they're not included in your bill. Is there any reason for that?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, yes, and it's because it has to be a very close proximity, and the exact how many miles out does it have to be? But it's done that way because obviously proximity matters here. If you're right on the border, obviously it's going to have a much more significant impact than if you're located.
Good enough. Thanks.
Senator Senjum, it has to do with the size of the competing city on the other side of the border also, I believe. Chair lays over Senate File 389 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Eakin. Let's do your Senate File 1500 while you're at the table.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this this bill is also dealing with the border cities issue. It modifies the what's known as the disparity reduction credit for North Dakota border cities. The credit now applies to Class 3A commercial industrial railroad public utility property, Class 4A and 4D apartments. The statutory threshold currently is 2.3% effective tax rate. And what this bill does is it replaces that 2.3% effective tax rates with an annually assessed average or lowest ETR of the corresponding city. So every year, they'll look at what the lowest estimated the effective tax rate is of the corresponding city. So in the case of Moorhead, it would be in North Dakota across the river, and it would be from the four qualifying cities if it is less than 2.3%. And it would set it at what the lowest effective tax rate is for the city of Fargo, for instance, for the city of Moorhead. So it would keep our property tax rates competitive with those of North Dakota, and again, help out our businesses to keep them here on the Minnesota side of the river, allow them more opportunity to expand and create more jobs, and which, again, is good for the whole state.
Mr. Redlinger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Senator Eakin noted, the disparities between the border communities have grown over some time now. And this has not really happened in just the last year or two, but rather has been a sequence of events that have had an accumulating effect of some significant reductions in the commercial industrial property tax rate on the North Dakota side. In the case of the city of Moorhead, at 2.3%, our businesses are starting to fall behind what the companion businesses across the river are doing. Again, just about a half mile to the west, depending on what school district that business might be located in, there's three school districts that operate in the city of Fargo, North Dakota, that effective tax rate might be as low as 1.62%, as high as 1.85%. Meanwhile, again, that same business in Minnesota is at 2.3%. So that's about a 20 to 30% reduction in that rate just by moving that half mile to the west. This is a real important issue for us, and Senator Eakin's bill, what it will do is index the program to make sure that further ground is not lost with these businesses and that they can maintain competitiveness by making sure that that they're right within the ball game. So the same case also in Grand Forks, East Grand Forks. One school district in the city of Grand Forks, North Dakota, one in the city of East Grand Forks, Minnesota, and so they would just come down to the same rate, and there would be parity there. So again, what we're trying to find here is an opportunity for these businesses, these employers, to keep business operations in Minnesota. A real win for Minnesota in that by the state participating in some of the property tax relief here, they're able to not be tempted and incented to jump across the river and head over to North Dakota to set up operations. That's a real important concept, and this is merely taking a good program and making it better, enhancing it and giving it that kind of stability that it needs long term so that those businesses retain their competitiveness in Minnesota, again, retain their jobs and grow jobs in Minnesota. Again, happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Senator Eakin, I think it might be problematic if we start tying our Minnesota city's tax rate to a tax rate from outside the state, but you're being creative anyway. Questions, members? Senator Senjum.
Does North Dakota have local government aid or something like it, or they just have an overall lesser tax rates on this kind of property?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Senator Senjum, a variety of revenue sources. There are some state road and bridge funds. There is no quote-unquote local government aid program for revenue sharing. There are, of course, a whole host of local option sales taxes, however, that fund things like library, street improvements. City of Fargo, for example, has multiple local option sales taxes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1500? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Eakin. Thank you, Mr. Redlinger. Chair lays over Senate File 1500 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown, thank you for being patient. Senate File 289.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before us, I have Senate File 289. This is a bill for Clearwater's local sales and use tax modification. This bill would amend the City of Clearwater's sales tax authorization that was originally enacted in 2008, and it would expand how they could use the revenues from their half-cent sales tax in the City of Clearwater. To explain the provisions in this bill that would expand that, I have Pete Edmondson. He's the mayor of Clearwater, and he can quickly give you the details on how this would be expanded.
Mayor Edmondson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you. In 2006, the voters of Clearwater approved a bill which would allow a local sales tax to be collected. That has been collecting since 2008. There's approximately $600,000 in that fund. The miscommunication happened on our part. In 2008, the legislature had stricken some of the language in our bill that was approved, striking out some parks, park improvements, recreations, similar language like that because of the lack of specifics. We were not aware of that. In 2011, we came back and asked the legislature to amend the bill, and we inaccurately asked the legislature to approve that and reference a capital improvement plan or a city improvement plan. That was our inaccuracy. We should have asked for the reference to be in a comprehensive plan. The capital city improvement plan had not existed. So we still had the capacity to use the funds to build a community center, recreation center, or pedestrian bridge, but it wasn't to the full extent that our voters were looking for park improvements and those types of things. And so we were asking here for the Senate to consider adding this to the omnibus bill with our amended changes.
Thank you. I'm just trying to find the language about the comprehensive plan in here.
City improvement plan.
Doesn't appear to be referenced, but.
City improvement
Mr. Chair?
Sure, Mr. Mayor Edmondson?
Yes, back in 2008, I'm looking at the file of it. In our new rejacketed information, some of that language is removed. when we look at, rather than referencing the plan now, we put in our specific requirements that we were asking for. We start to lay out the parks and what we our intentions were. So you won't find that information there anymore.
Okay. And, Mayor, just so I'm clear, you are collecting the sales tax, but have you expended any of it?
Mr. Chair, at this moment, no. The restraints that we had on it, the planning for a community center, the recreation center, pedestrian bridge, were out of our budget goals at that time. And so we were more intending to start with some of the park improvements, some of the open space, and moving down some of those bonding options.
And so regional parks, regional bike trails, that doesn't fit the language, and now you're just spelling out the specific projects? And you felt these other defining words didn't fulfill the need? I'm not understanding why you're being so specific when you've got this development of regional parks, bike trails, parkland, open space, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, I think that the third version, which came in 2011, rather than itemizing these things, it had referenced the city improvement plan, and that's where because the plan was not in existence.
Oh, I see.
So we came back with pulling out that reference and putting in these specifics.
And you do have a comprehensive plan, though?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's true.
Can you tell me what that is?
It's a December of 2006 city comprehensive plan.
Okay. Well, we'll have to figure this out. Any questions, members? Senator
Reinert.
Reinert, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What am I blanking on today?
It's okay. It's a Monday morning. Senator Brown and Mayor, this is a little bit off topic, but on my drive down, I always hit this dead spot, and I end up picking up St. Cloud radio stations, and there's some great place in Clearwater that makes French bread out of, like, this apple strudel thing. So the next time you come, if you could bring some of that, that would be fantastic.
Senator Brown.
Senator Reinert, we'd be happy to. That would be the Clearwater Travel Plaza,
yes.
Very similar to what's Toby's and Hinckley's. So it's a fantastic place, along with Keith Skettle. I think outside of the Farmer's Daughter, they're two of the governor's favorite restaurants. So
sounded tasty.
Yeah.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 289? Thank you. Senator Brown, Mayor, we'll try to work this out so the language works for everybody. And it's
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Chair lays over Senate File 289 for possible inclusion. Senator Carlson.
Senator Carlson, welcome to the committee. We have before us Senate File 607. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, do you have the fiscal note that just came out? This one. We just printed it off ourselves here.
I don't think we have it.
It's neutral, so it really makes no difference.
It's not anything. We don't have a fiscal note. We have a revenue estimate, and that is, it shows neutral.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senate File 607 is a new system that we would like to have put in place so that municipalities can charge, they can establish a street program, street maintenance program, and charge a street fee of the properties that are within a maintenance district and use that maintenance to improve the life of streets. There are some things that are still being worked on as far as the charitable properties that might be in a district, but we have, as far as the technicalities of the bill, I have Ms. Ann Finn here from the League of Minnesota Cities, which is very strongly in support of this, and Mark Maloney, engineer from Shoreview, who can describe more of the technicalities in this process of street maintenance. With that, Mr. Maloney will explain to you what the municipalities plan to do with it.
Senator Carlson.
I'm sorry, we have a handout here also, if we could.
Could you take us through the sections of the bill first, please?
Okay. Excuse me, Madam Chair, I don't have that page right at hand here. Okay, what Subdivision 1 does is it defines all of the relevant terms within the bill. And again, there are some words here that are still in some change, some flux. And what we're doing is we're describing the improvements. We're describing the governing body, which is any municipality, and the maintenance, which is striping, seal coating, crack sealing, pavement repair, sidewalk maintenance, and signal maintenance, as well as the mill and overlay. And then a street, of course, is any street or public roadway. The authorization has to be done within a municipality after they adopt a street maintenance plan by that municipality, and then it needs to be passed by ordinance. And, of course, uniformity means that all properties that are in the same category must be, I hate to use the term assessed, but it is charged. A charge is consistent on that property. The fees can only be used for that particular maintenance district, and they must be used on streets. The collection period is good for 20 years. However, if you look at the end of the bill, it does have a sundown. This is to sundown in 5 years. But the collection period can last 20 years, and this is more or less to determine whether this is a worthwhile way to collect street fees.
And Senator Carlson, these fees are charged on against all properties. Is that correct?
At this stage, yes, they are. Yes, we are looking at some.
Pardon me? Including tax exempt properties.
Yes, yes, we are looking at exempting a certain type of charitable property. This would be the Subdivision 7 properties that are for our charitable nonprofits.
That's not Subdivision 7.
It's Subdivision 7 in the property descriptions in another part of language. Here, let's see if I can pull that up.
Senator Carlson, do you have an amendment you'd like us to look at?
At this stage, there's still some things that are being changed on it, and okay. I guess it would be the preference of the chair whether we go ahead and amend it with some. There's still some minor changes that need to be done.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, I think at least if the intention is that there's going to be the fee will not be applied to some tax-exempt charitable organizations. I'd at least like to see that language, even if it's not perfect, Senator Carlson. So we'll have the whole proposal in front of us rather than holding off on it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest, I think that's right from my intent. Also, I understood from the discussions that we had that we were going to be making sure that all properties were included in this, not exempting other ones. So if there is exemptions, we're going to have to see that language before it leaves the committee, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, I would think so, too. And this is not – this is a decision of the committee because this is not the first stop for this bill, so it's not an author's any amendment taken up here is not an author's amendment. It is a decision on the part of the committee.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Carlson, the amendment's not ready.
We have an amendment, yes. There was one change that Arizovsky from the Transportation Committee was doing with it. We could put it in, if you'd like, the way it is today.
And like Senator, to do that. Senator Carlson, should we pass the amendment out that you have and discuss what it does and see if it's something we think we can deal with, or would you rather wait for another day?
We can do it now. Yeah. We have to make copies.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hear the testimony, and they can make copies. We've got quite a list of testifiers here. Is there something in the amendment that we should just briefly mention so the testimony can reflect it? Or?
Sure. Yes. If you'd like to put the amendment on today, there are some things that are changed significantly. One is that we are changing the description from street improvement to street maintenance. So it would apply to maintenance only instead of redoing a street. We also, as you mentioned, or as we touched on here, is to take away the notion of tax-exempt charitable property. These would be the ones that are called out in that subdivision 7, which is section 27202, subdivision 7, and that is an institution of public charity.
Would be exempt.
It would be exempt, yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's go to testifiers. And I was stepped out, so I don't know where we're at.
Just started.
We hadn't, I had asked, Mr. Chairman, I had asked Senator Carlson to take us through the bill section by section. So, because this is the first time that now? Many members of this committee have seen this bill.
And have we completed that now, Senator?
I think we had gotten down to adoption of the plan, subdivision 4. So maybe if we just briefly go through the rest of the subdivisions, starting on page 2, subdivision 4, that would be helpful, Senator Carlson, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Senator Carlson, could you pick up where you left off then?
Okay. We were talking about the we had gone through the definitions and the authorization and uniformity. And the adoption of a plan, subdivision 4, is that the maintenance district would be subject to approval of a street plan by the municipality. And that would estimate and identify what, in the case of this amendment, what maintenance plan would be in place for that area of streets.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Carlson, is it your intention then that every time the phrase street improvement is used, you're changing that to street maintenance?
Exactly.
In your
Russ,
amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to ask. Okay.
Senator Carlson, okay. I understand there's a problem with the amendment. It's been drafted by the transportation staff, not by tax committee staff. We're not sure that we're going to be able to get that ready today. So let's go through the bill. We'll hear the testimony, understanding that you're going to have to come back another day, it looks like.
Okay. Okay, and just to finish up with the sections, the maintenance fee would be imposed as a fee on as a utility fee, similar to a utility fee, and then it would not be replacing an assessment system. That's subdivision 8. It would not be exclusive and not replace an assessment system, and then we would not be applying these fees to brand new developments, because you don't need maintenance there, so they would not be paying their paying a maintenance fee for at least 3 years. And then, of course, the effective date was July 1st with a sundown of June 30th of 2018.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Questions, members? Okay, let's move on to Ms. Fox. Or I don't know, who's up to it?
Ben.
Yes. Hello, I'm Mark Maloney, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mark Maloney. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Shoreview. I've been employed for the city of Shoreview for 19 years, and I was employed for the city of Brooklyn Center in a similar capacity for 5 years before that. So I have 24 years experience of managing transportation infrastructure for local government. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to be here today. I'm here on behalf of the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, as well as the American Public Works Association Minnesota chapter. And we're the professionals that the local, that the public is asking to manage these local assets for them. It's our job to make sure these things are being managed in the most cost-effective way. We monitor the condition of pavements and make programming and funding recommendations to local elected officials so that people get the most from their road system and can get to and from their homes, their jobs, and their schools. Like all road authorities in this economy, we're struggling to find the resources necessary to manage our street infrastructure as it wears out. The most cost-effective way to manage these assets is to perform the right kinds of preventative maintenance and rehabilitation strategies at the time they're necessary. The chart that I handed out is a life cycle curve. That's just a generic approach to looking at what happens to roads. You could use probably the same shape curve for a lot of infrastructure. In this particular case, it shows that investing $1 at the right time with the right type of rehabilitation strategy in this life cycle is going to save taxpayers $6 or $7 or even more later on. And so that's what this authority would allow cities to do, would give us a tool to address this pavement decay curve and spend money wisely at the right time. Local government needs the authority to create funding tools that allow and encourage us to do the right thing at the right time, whether we're talking about patching or seal coating or crack filling or reclamation. Using the tax levy for these things is not the answer, given all the things competing for those resources, including public safety and the rising costs of addressing water quality and environmental concerns. We've learned the hard way that the tax levy is not the best place to try to fund long-term public infrastructure needs. Municipal state aid, which is our share of state gas tax revenues, at best only applies to 20% of our system, and it isn't even fully available for our own roadways, given that we use that money to do cost match or cost share participation when there's a regional project in our community. Special assessments are relevant only for new construction or complete reconstruction, which by definition is the least cost-effective time to spend money on road rehabilitation. With special assessments, and even though the streets are public assets that have life cycles that go off into decades, whomever happens to be living there at the time of the project is going to get stuck with the bill. And it's a potentially large special assessment for reconstruction. This has really come to light in my community in recent years at our public hearings, where the realities of a rising number of fixed income seniors and struggling young families are brought to light. It would seem fair to have a funding mechanism that collected the necessary money for these maintenance strategies a little at a time for property owners, as opposed to one big lump sum at the time of the reconstruction or the rehabilitation. The authority in this bill would allow cities to create the tools necessary to support the high quality of life that our residents are proud of and to manage the street system in a way that encourages business retention, job creation, and business development. All of this public infrastructure is a premise for all of those things that we're trying to accomplish in local government. Street improvement districts would be fair and transparent way for property owners to participate in the costs of maintaining the infrastructure that they depend on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Ann Finn with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm just here to answer questions.
Oh, okay. Questions, members? Senator Sanjum.
Mr. Chair, to anyone at the dais there, is it conceivable that a neighborhood, a zone of a city could be in a transportation improvement district and a street assessment district at the same time?
Do you want to answer that one?
Is that precluded in the bill? I guess that's the question. Anything's possible. It's not precluded in the bill.
Senator Chair and Senator Sinjum, an assessment against the property for a complete street rebuild, yes, is different than an ongoing fee for maintenance. So yes, they could be in the same district at one time. But the uses of the funds would be different. One would be for maintenance that would increase the life of the street. The other one would be for complete reconstruction.
And initial construction, at least.
Correct.
Where I live. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the word transparent. I think one of you mentioned that it was a transparent way it was transparent for citizens, and I thought I might have heard the word free, but maybe not. We know there's no free lunch. But my question has to do with kind of that transparency issue. Right now, if I understand correctly, road street improvement and maintenance is currently paid for out of property taxes. And at least the voters have an opportunity at truth and taxation hearings. They have opportunities to vote for or against their council members who would approve these property taxes. And as I understand this legislation, it's actually taking that ability away from citizens in the fact that suddenly, instead of now part of what their local officials decide to do and is presented at a truth and taxation hearing, now all of a sudden it's a fee that's just applied by ordinance. And so that's one question. It seems like you're removing this from the people, which I don't think is transparent. And then the second question is, you know, will their property taxes be reduced by the amount of the former of the budget that used to be paid for by property taxes for city improvement and maintenance? So two questions.
And so, Senator Carlson, or maybe Mr. Maloney, when you're answering that question, you will talk about the difference between a special assessment property tax and then this funding mechanism, because there's kind of going to be three if this is to become law. Senator Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. There still requires the same similar types of hearings. Again, there needs to be a street improvement plan that is heard by the residents, and there's a specification in there of giving notice before this plan is developed. And then the maintenance district could be the entire city, it could be a section of the city, and people would know what that maintenance is going for. So it would, and that would be for, the intention is to increase the life of streets as opposed to rebuilding a street, which would be a special assessment. And that would, the special assessments, there's different policies on those. It could be by front foot, it could be all sorts of other mechanisms that they use for special assessments. But your special assessments actually go under your property taxes.
And Senator Nelson, I think the special assessment is only for the properties that abut the project. I think that's probably the case. And what the difference is, from what I understand this proposal, is that instead of just having the properties that abut the street pay for the curb and gutter or whatever they're working on, they develop a district, which might actually bring in properties that are behind, not abutting, but that utilize the street. I think that's the rationale that they're going after here. And your question about the property tax is perfectly fair, because that would be the normal mechanism that you would expect the local government to utilize. And they're trying to develop this new other mechanism. And so I think discussion about that is very good. Senator Rest.
Just following up on that, I do think it's really important to understand what authorities the cities might have in doing these public works improvements or maintenance. And of course, special assessments and property taxes are separately stated on your property tax statement, and you may not take a special assessment since it benefits your property. You may not take that as a deduction on your income tax return, which is why some cities have gone away from a special assessment system, and they do indeed do improvements or replacements of streets on the property tax, and everybody pays for it every year, but you also get a deduction on your property taxes. One of my cities started doing that, putting it all on the property tax, no special assessments, when they were at the end of a street improvement cycle, which is the best place to do it because then you're not hitting people twice. Pay for your street this year, and next year you start paying for everybody's street. When they have finished a cycle, that's when, almost finished a cycle, that's when they went to the all property tax system rather than a system of special assessments and property tax. And the street improvement or street maintenance would be a fee imposed on within a district set up that would be separate from any special assessments, which are benefits to a particular property in reconstructing a street, and also would not be deductible on your income tax.
And Senator Rest, just so we're all clear, the assessments and the fees are not deductible on the income tax.
They are not. Neither one. Neither one. Property tax is, fees and assessments are not.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there is concern about how this is going to impact folks and their property taxes. And I didn't get answers, though, to my question about why this would be any more transparent. It does appear to me that it's not. To Senator Carlson's point, I understand, legislation correctly, that there is the one-time opportunity where this is placed into ordinance. But when you're talking about property taxes and city leaders coming to the residents on property taxes, that's a yearly thing. This appears to me like it's a one-time ordinance that's put into place, and it really removes the citizens' input and ability to talk to their city council members about this.
Senator, Mr. Maloney?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I use the word transparency, and the transparency that I'm referring to is that any of the money that would be collected with this would be collected in accordance with a plan. There has to be a plan for what the money is going to be spent on, whereas I know that when we do road maintenance activities from the tax levy does not have that level of specificity in it in terms of how much money are we spending on this road with what type of strategies. So this proposed legislation requires the adoption of a plan that identifies in advance all of those activities which are going to occur in the district that the fees are being collected for. So that's the transparency that I was referring to.
Seeing no more questions. Senator Carlson, there is a list of 8 testifiers that we need to work our way through, and we've got to be done by 11. I think the bill is going to be laid over for further discussion, so let's go to testimony and see what folks have to say. Jenny Fox, Ms. Fox, Mr. Milner, and Ms. Larson, can we get 3 up there? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeannie Fox. I'm the Deputy Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I appreciate the author's remarks. He has listened to the concerns of the nonprofit community. So I think I will leave testimony on the bill to the other people, but if I may just briefly give some context to the committee for the I don't have a copy of the amendment, but what Senator Carlson is describing here. Article 10 on taxation in the state constitution exempts.
Ms. Fox, I think you should put your testimony to the bill as it's presented. It hasn't been amended, and we don't have the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Article 10 exempts public institutions, colleges and universities, churches, and then this term you heard, institutions of public, purely public charity. And prior to 2009, that term had not been defined in statute. And the Council of Nonprofits worked for 2 years with the Department of Revenue, with the County Assessors Association, and many of you, actually, to do that. So, but I would say the to be brief, the main concern the council had on behalf of our 2,000 members around the state in all areas of charitable activity were that this is indeed a property tax and violates the spirit and the history and the practice of exempting organizations from the property tax.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fox.
Exempt from the special assessments.
Mr. Milner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jacob Milner, and I am representing the Minnesota Auto Dealer Association, and we're here to express our concerns with Senate File 607. You should all have in your packets a one-pager from us, and there's actually more organizations. There are now 30 organizations ranging from nonprofits, faith communities, businesses, and business associations opposed to this bill for several reasons, and I'll quickly lay out our concerns. Our first concern is that the bill gives broad authority to municipalities to increase taxes for these improvement projects. We believe that there already exist several taxing mechanisms available at the municipal level to allow them to raise revenue and pay for these projects. Under this proposal, as it stands right now, there is no need for a city to prove a benefit to the affected property to justify imposing the fee. It only says that it will benefit the district, not that the property will be necessarily benefited. So it's conceivable that your property could be located within the taxing district but not be located near where the improvement is taking place or get any benefit from that improvement. Nonetheless, you'll still have to pay for those fees on your property to finance that. Additionally, cities under this legislation are free to draw the taxing districts in any shape, allowing them to impose a fees only on certain properties if they wish. Nothing would prohibit a city from imposing a street improvement fee in such a way that minimally affects, for example, homeowners who vote, but burden commercial property owners who oftentimes don't live in the same community where the business is located. We view this as unfair, and there's seemingly, as I said, no limit on how a city can devise its fee system according to this legislation. Furthermore, the fees authorized by this bill do not sunset after a particular project has been completed, and once imposed can be collected from property owners for up to 20 years and can theoretically be renewed for another 20-year period after it expires. And finally, again, we believe property owners are already paying for street improvements through taxes, through special assessments and other various methods, and that those are our concerns with this legislation at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We also oppose Senate File 607. As this committee knows, businesses pay basically two property taxes. We pay the local property taxes like all other properties do, but we also pay the statewide general levy. And our concern with this proposal is it's just a third property tax. And the way that it's crafted, at least at this point in time, as Mr. Milner mentioned, there is absolutely no assurance that business property wouldn't pay the majority of this new fee or tax as we see it. There's nothing in the legislation that talks about how the fee would be assessed. And in fact, there's nothing in the legislation that talks about that the plan that would be put forward at a public hearing, that the plan would have to include any detailed information. It just says that the plan has to say what the estimated costs would be. It doesn't say how those costs would be assessed. It doesn't say how they would be paid for, if it would be on your utility bill, over what period of time. And so we have some strong concerns that this would be just be another property tax paid for disproportionately by business property. And we think that there are other mechanisms in place, TIF, street special service districts, special assessments, and the property tax that are already in place to be used to do street maintenance. Thank you.
And Ms. Larson, you know, when I first looked at this, I thought perhaps that the business community might actually be supporting this because they currently can do the special assessment on the street, and it's just the properties that are abutting contiguous to the street that pay. And if this district idea was to become move forward, they would actually be bringing more people into the district than just the properties right on the main on the street, people that utilize it. So you would be actually lowering the costs to the people who are the business that is right on the street, it looks to me, as opposed to using a traditional assessment mechanism. And I'm wondering, has anybody kind of walked through that and thought through that? It might not actually be a benefit to those that abut the street to make the district bigger that for paying for it.
Mr. Chairman, members, I understand your point, and I think that our concern is that they're real, but that could happen. But the way that this bill is drafted, our concern is that a city, for example, they could make an entire city an improvement district. Mm-hmm. And they could choose to have business property pay 99% of the cost of those improvements. Because if the language says it has to be equal based on classification rate within the classification system, so they could say, well, all homestead property, we will allocate that equally within homestead property, and they're going to pay 5% of it, and business property could pay theoretically 95% of it. So while I agree with your potential example, our concern is that even if it were to spread the cost, that cost could be disproportionately spread on just business property and not on other properties that may also benefit from the improvement. Mm-hmm. I agree. The special assessment process, you know, has its faults, and as the gentleman from Shoreview explained, I mean, I've lived through it in my city. People don't like getting that big bill when they have a special assessment on their property, and as Senator Ress mentioned, many cities are moving away from that because of that issue, and I think what we're saying is that there are other ways to mitigate that concern without imposing a new fee or what we see as a new tax.
Okay, thank you. Questions, members? Senator Sanjom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Larson, there are probably more things wrong with the bill than just that one, but I don't like that one either, at least in our town. And, you know, it was uniform, at least, say sidewalks, $11 a foot. Didn't matter if you were whatever classification you're, you know, residential, VFW, running in front of a business. If that one could be solved, do you feel better about the bill?
Ms. Larson.
If the whole issue about, you know, equal assessments regardless of property classification could be solved, because I tend to agree with you, they ought to be even.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Larson, maybe I could restate. What if we were to use market value as a method of assessing for this? Would that solve some of the problems?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sanjom, I think we'd have to look at the language. I think our concern is that this is just another tax. I think Senator Nelson brought up some good points about the transparency or lack thereof, in that how this would be enacted. Again, the city that I live in did something like this a few years ago, and it was enacted at 1:30 in the morning. I was there. I was one of two people there. And so that's our concern, I think, is that this, it deviates from the existing process to fund roads. It's another mechanism that I don't think we believe is necessary. But, you know, of course, we'd be willing to look at language.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanjom.
You know, every town's different, but I will tell you, at least where I live, notices of a public hearing on assessment to your property that might be in the neighborhood of $10,000, it does bring out people. There is transparency. It's looking at your friends and neighbors right in the face and deciding whether this is a good idea or not. So I can think of, you may or may not like the bill, but I can think of nothing more transparent than a local public hearing on a street improvement. I've been there many times.
It's in the bill.
Yeah, Senator Sanjom, yeah. I think that's included
in the
bill.
It's in the bill. Yeah. Subdivision 4 requires a public hearing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And notice.
We're going to move along. Ms. Rakow, Ms. Keith, Mr. Hickey. Is this a meeting? Welcome to tax committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIAP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, representing the interests of developers, owners, and managers of commercial real estate, along with the thousands of business tenants that are in the buildings we own and manage. You know, everybody talks about how complicated our property tax system is and how we should work to simplify it. Giving local jurisdictions yet another way to tax property, especially out of the normal process we're all accustomed to, makes it even more complicated. And this is the kind of thing that frustrates taxpayers and ultimately causes cynicism. In addition, I have to say that it's very difficult to reconcile the pressure around here to provide property tax relief with giving local jurisdictions yet another way to tax those same properties, not call it a property tax, but call it a street maintenance fee. It would seem to us that if a local jurisdiction needs additional money for street maintenance, they should design a plan, make the case to their taxpayers, and use existing mechanisms such as the property tax to pay for street maintenance. We just have to ask, why is yet another mechanism needed to tax those same properties? Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Rocco. Ms. Keefe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Alliance of YMCAs and also the Girl Scouts Joint Legislative Committee. Both the Y and the Girl Scouts are very concerned about the impact of this bill, and that's why we're part of a very broad and diverse coalition that is opposing the bill. Both the Y and the Girl Scouts are charitable organizations. Our property is tax exempt, and yet under this bill, we would be required to pay what is really a property tax. We're tax exempt for a reason. We contribute to the public good, and we relieve the burdens of government. The exemption for charities is in the state constitution. In 2009, the state law setting standards for property tax exemptions for institutions of public charity was rewritten in order to provide more clarity and consistency. The nonprofit community, and we were a part of that, worked for over a year with the Department of Revenue and the assessors and with tax committee members to conduct an extensive review of those standards. And in the end, I think there was broad agreement that what we came up with was really very good and that organizations that meet the standards truly deserve a property tax exemption. When fees like the street improvement fee in this bill are imposed to pay for things that have been and are currently paid for with property taxes, that undermines the purpose of our exemption. And we think this also sets a very bad precedent. You could take a city budget and you could chop it into dozens of pieces and impose fees for almost every service. So what's next? A snow removal fee, a police and fire protection fee, a park fee? Where does it end? We don't think you should go down this path. We urge you to oppose this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We represent 13,000 small businesses across the state. Many of them are commercial property owners and payers, and just wanted to make a few brief comments and not be overly redundant. We are very concerned about this bill, and I think the major point here, you know, without getting into all the specifics, is just a major departure from how we currently do special assessments. And as you currently know, you have to live on the street, abut the street, live near the street. I'm not an expert on municipal law, but the reach isn't too far. Maybe on a highway, the reach is further than a quiet street. I'm going through this right now on my house. I know many of you have been through it, and I'm not happy with what I'm going to be billed, but it's probably going to be mostly just the people on my street. It's a quiet street in South Minneapolis, and we're the ones who benefit from it, not somebody who lives six blocks away. So we're very concerned about the departure we're making from current law here and where that leads us. Also very concerned about the wide open nature of it. How are they going to tax people? Could commercial property end up carrying a lot of the load, carrying the bag on this, carrying a lot of the load? As Ms. Larson mentioned, we don't need a third tax on commercial property. Our taxes are high despite numerous efforts to try to lower them over the last decade or so. This could be a new third one that could really hit some properties hard. And finally, the fee doesn't end when the project's done. It goes on potentially for 20 years, which is very concerning, and responsibility really seems to be lost there. And we'd urge you to oppose this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Thank you. Mr. McGann, Ms. Johansson, and Mr. Roberts, can we get, I guess we'll just do two of you, and Ms. Roberts can be last.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Scott McMahon. I'm with the Minnesota Private College Council. We represent the 17 nonprofit liberal arts colleges and universities that are members, schools like Augsburg, the College of St. Scholastica, Gustavus Adolphus College. Our member institutions are granted their tax-exempt status under Article 10, Section 1 of the state's Constitution, where academies, colleges, and universities are specifically identified as exempt from taxation. Article 10, Section 1 also states that legislature may authorize municipal corporations to levy and collect assessments for local improvements upon property benefited thereby without regard to cash valuation. This is the origin of the benefit test for tax-exempt properties, which must be satisfied for a municipality to assess fees on tax-exempt properties. The proposal outlined in Senate File 607 would permit municipalities to assess fees on our colleges and universities without fulfilling the benefit test requirement because the projects and the costs associated with them are based on the benefit to the district, not to the property. Regarding the broad authority that would be issued to a municipality under this bill, the municipality is granted the authority to draw the district however it wants and to distribute the costs and the improvement projects uniformly across each classification of real estate, which means that the cost does not need to be distributed uniformly across all properties, but only uniformly within a property class. So what does this mean for our nonprofit colleges? Under this bill, a city could draw a district that includes a nonprofit university and only residential properties. It could then identify street improvements within the district that under a normal review would not pass the benefits test required under the state's constitution and assess up to 100% of the improvement costs on the college if the college's property is classified as something other than residential and it is the only non-residential property located within the improvement district. The proposal included in Senate File 607 encroaches upon, if not directly violates, the protection for tax-exempt properties outlined in the state's constitution. Our colleges currently contribute significant resources to local municipalities for fees that comply with the benefits test requirement. In FY12, our 17 institutions paid $8.2 million in municipal fees and assessments, a 43% increase since FY05. To put this cost in perspective, based on our average tuition, our schools need to enroll about 600 students and use 100% of that tuition revenue in order to pay the fees in schools our schools currently are assessed. Additional costs added to our institutions require them to either pass the cost on to the students through tuition increases or cut expenses that will have a negative impact on the academic and student support offerings our colleges provide. These are the very things that the Constitution asks us to do, and which grants us our tax-exempt status. Regarding the conversation you all are going to have in a little while on the amendment, we don't fall under Subdivision 7. We're a Subdivision 5 institution. Things that aren't included in that are churches, local schools, colleges, universities.
Mr. McMahon, do you know, does St. Thomas pay the streetlight assessment in St. Paul?
I don't have the specific details on it, but I do know that that there are a number of fees and assessments that St. Thomas does pay.
If you could get that information to me, I'd appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I can get you by school what our schools are paying.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employer members, 80% of which are small businesses. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 607. The Chamber opposes this legislation for a few simple reasons. I'll direct my testimony today to the bill as it stands, but would note preemptively for your discussion of the amendment that while limiting the legislation to maintenance is appreciated, it narrows the scope but doesn't necessarily alleviate the underlying concerns that the Chamber has with this legislation. Out of respect for the committee's time, I'll echo the concerns of those who have gone before me by just distilling them into a few quick themes. First, we are concerned that the legislation is very broad. Being able to draw a district or structure rates without a lot of parameters put around it does lead to the opportunity to disproportionately impact some residents or businesses more than others, and that's a concern for us for the reasons that Ms. Larson articulated. Second, we think that this is a deviation from the standard policy rationale that usually is associated with this type of fee. Usually there's a nexus between use or benefit and those who finance a particular street improvement. That, of course, is deviated from in this particular piece of legislation. Third, we're concerned about the timing. A few previous testifiers have pointed out the idea that this is a 5 to 20-year expiration date for these particular improvement fees or levies. Now, certainly, what would most likely happen is that a particular improvement or maintenance project would catalyze the implementation of such a fee, but it wouldn't necessarily be the conclusion. The bottom line is that this revenue stream would likely exceed in time and potentially revenue the length the need that precipitated it. And then finally, as others have noted, we think this is duplicative. There are other mechanisms existing, and if those are inadequate, if the committee is striving to simplify our tax, particularly at local levels, simplifying that structure through refining current mechanisms is preferable to adding one that has extremely broad authority and the other problems that I have noted in my testimony. For those reasons, I would urge your opposition to the bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Roberts?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ethan Roberts, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council, which is the public affairs voice for Minnesota's Jewish community. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify. This is an incredibly diverse coalition. I think it's the most diverse coalition I've ever had the privilege to be a part of. I think it's worth noting this is the first time I've testified this session in either chamber. It's not normally something I seek to do, but it was important for us to be here today to speak on behalf of the Jewish community's social service providers, nonprofits, which provide a full spectrum of services to some of our most vulnerable Minnesotans from all backgrounds, irrespective of their religious faith, from quality early childhood education, Meals on Wheels, hospice care, services for disabled, the list goes on and on and on. We're proud partners with the government in providing services which make Minnesota a better place. I echo much of the testimony from Ms. Keith, who I've been traveling around this session with on another issue related to our shared interest in YMCAs and JCCs. We're concerned like they are because despite the strong partnership that we have with government and the charitable work which we perform, there's no recognition in this legislation as it now stands, and I'm appreciative of what you said earlier, but as it now stands, as it's now before this committee, of the traditional property tax exemption. And yes, we understand it's a fee and it's not a tax, but you know, to some extent, members, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. I'm pretty sure Aristotle first said that. I could be wrong. It wouldn't be the first time today. In any event, whatever you want to call it, a tax or a fee, we're disappointed and we're concerned, but encouraged, I guess, hopeful. I'd also add, just personally, as a board member for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, I was there over this past couple of years when we negotiated in very good faith and very productively with the Department of Revenue and the county tax assessors, and we reached a really good compromise. And the bipartisan approval, the affirmation in 2009 for Section 7 institutions, I think, is something that I urge this committee to respect. And I'm encouraged. I think this is going in the right direction. But, you know, as the bill now sits before you today, we felt like we needed to say something. And you know, good luck with the rest of your committee's work. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, and commend Senator Carlson for bringing everyone together this year.
In full disclosure, I used to work with Jacob Milner. He used to work at the JCRC. I never thought I would work with the auto dealers on any issue, but thank you, Senator Carlson. I appreciate that.
Senator Carlson, we're going to lay this over for further discussion. Do you have anything else you'd like to say? Any questions?
Nothing specific other than you know that one of the things we need to keep in mind is that this is intended to lower the ultimate costs of our streets by maintaining them, and that's where the $1 the $7 benefit from a $1 early investment is relevant. We need to look at that. We need to keep that in mind. The more you maintain something, the longer it lasts, and the fewer times it has to be totally replaced.
And Senator Carlson, as you move toward more and more exemptions to the proposal, it becomes more and more like a property tax, and it could just as well be a property tax at that point. So we're going to lay Senate file, oops, I can't read it, 607 over for further discussion. Thank you, members. We're planning our meeting on Wednesday and Friday in full committee, Senator Rest Tuesday and Thursday in division. Anything else, members? Thank you. Committee's adjourned.